Vicki Rideout, and I'm a vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation and the director of our program for the study of media and health. And thank you all for joining us here today for our event, The Health Blogosphere, What It Means for Policy Debates and Journalism. So today's discussion is important to us at the Kaiser Family Foundation because our entire mission is to produce and communicate the best possible information and policy on health issues. So it's vital for us to understand how the world is consuming information and to ensure, probably like everybody else in this room, that our information is being delivered through effective channels. One way that we've adapted to the growing role of blogging in the health policy field is that we've begun a new feature on our Kaiser Daily Health Policy Report called Blog Watch, which is a twice-weekly roundup of health policy-related posts drawn from a list of blogs that are monitored by the foundation. But given how new the blogosphere is, there are also a lot of unanswered questions about the role of blogging and its impact on the news business, on the public's access to information, and on the policy environment in this country. How are blogs impacting the news business as a whole? Are they improving the quality and depth of information that's communicated, or are they placing too much emphasis on brevity and on speed? How big an audience are they really reaching? How much of the health policy blogosphere in particular is about delivering information and opinion, and how much is about marketing and PR? And will a health reform debate in 2009, if we have one, look different because of the existence of blogs and their participation in the conversation? These are all questions that we'll be talking about when we get to our panel discussion in just a few moments. But first, we're going to hear from one very prominent blogger. Secretary Michael Levitt was the first U.S. Cabinet Secretary to have his own blog, offering us all a peek behind the scenes at the Department of Health and Human Services. He has served as Secretary of HHS for the past 3.5 years, managing one of the largest civilian departments in the federal government. In August of 2007, Secretary Levitt made his first post, writing that, quote, "I've decided to wade in a little deeper into blogdom by writing one for the next month or so. I'm going to see how I feel after that time period. I may continue, I may not. Let's give it a try and see what happens." Almost a year and many posts later, he's still at it. Like many other bloggers, he's blogged about his decision to blog, about when and where he blogs, and about the challenges of blogging. But he's also blogged about SCHIP, import safety, emergency preparedness, healthcare costs, and medical errors, among many other topics. So I know he will have a lot to say about the role of blogging in the health policy debate. Please join me in welcoming Secretary Michael Levitt.
My appearance here today could be considered a response to John, who was a commenter on my blog. His question was, doesn't a cabinet secretary have something better to do than write a blog? Time will tell. I thought today I would simply lay out some questions that I think would be logical for people to ask about this and then just respond to them. And then at the end, there will be other questions that you have that you'd like to query, and I'd be happy to respond at that point. Let me ask the logical. When did you start and why? Vicki began that conversation. It was in August of 2007. I'd been discussing this with my chief of staff, Rich McKeon, for some time, who said, there's really something going on here. We need to figure out how to harness it. I've always been a fan of the web. When I was governor, we were among the first states to have a website. We set as a state goal to be the best of web in our category. We put a lot of services online. I've always been able to see a powerful engine that could drive public policy and public services. We had the experience at HHS of using a pandemic flu blog to advance a summit on pandemic flu. It was a wild success. We had hundreds of comments coming from the flubies that I came to understand on the blog, quite active group that I still communicate with regularly on my blog. I could see at that moment that this was indeed a very powerful engine for public policy setting. I felt it had an enormous effect in terms of, enormously powerful effect in terms of leading up, chronicling, and giving long life to what happened. We've begun using new media tools throughout HHS. For example, we can see the need for us to reach an audience of early adolescents, for example, through some means other than just traditional PSAs. That's not where they're going for their information. So we've developed a partnership with YouTube, where later in the fall we'll begin to not just have YouTube postings, but actually inviting people to make YouTube entries with the idea of allowing them to be part of the creative process. Julia Gerberding now has an avatar on Second Life, where people can go and meet her and talk about public health issues. So the bottom line is, I just wanted to try this. As was pointed out, I didn't know how it would work. I committed in my own mind to 6 weeks. I thought I would see how much time it took. I thought I would find out if I liked it, how people responded to it, if anybody read it. I wanted to set realistic expectations for myself and for other people, hence the introduction that was made. Now, I need to say I feel like I'm an adequate writer. I do not see myself as a highly skilled writer. I like to write, and I wanted to write this myself. I didn't want this to be a staff-driven, glorified press release that we would put out, vetted by lots of people. And so I was upfront about that. I'm going to write this myself. You'll likely see some mistakes, but let's try this together. I didn't want it to be vetted by a lot of people, and it's not. And I frankly expect it. I made a few people nervous. And maybe after a year they're more nervous. I don't know, but that was the rule I started off with. Now, it's been nearly a year, as pointed out, and I'm still writing it. So how's it gone? Well, I write an average of a couple times a week, sometimes more, once in a while less. The readership has not been off the chart. I think I average about 2,100 visits a week. Yeah, I mean, we're pushing 10,000 a month now. I have no idea where that fits in terms of I look at our links and our comments, and I assume that my son's MySpace page probably does better than I do. But nevertheless, it's a start. Now, I've actually written it myself, as I put forward that I would. Now, I need to make clear I don't take the time to polish it up. I generally will write it, and I'll give it to somebody in the department who's a little better at punctuation than I am, to proofread it and edit it. I quite often will send a copy of it before I post it to various people in the department and ask them to look at it for accuracy. I ask them to look at it for political or cultural sensitivity. I'll ask them to just second check my judgment on occasion. But the words are mine, all of them. How long does it take? Well, I probably spend a couple of hours a week at this. However, I found that the time I spend writing the blog produces a lot of side benefits. I tend to think through problems clearly when I'm trying to put words to them. And I tend to write my own policy speeches for the same reason. When I'm forced to craft words around ideas, it crystallizes my thought and forces me to ask, what do I believe? Now, once I've written a piece for the blog, I've found that speech writers at HHS are constantly drawing from that. It's obviously a way that they're able to find my thoughts and know my thoughts and find my voice. And that's an unexpected benefit to this. I had not anticipated that. I reuse the material a lot. It's essentially speech writing on an ongoing basis. It's a sort of off-Broadway place. I can try ideas and see how people respond to it. I've also begun to see it happening in reverse. I I write, in the last few months of the time I'm at HHS, I've laid out a goal to set out what I call the prologue series, which is a series of speeches that I'm writing to reflect on what I've learned in public policy over the last 16 years, particularly about health. And I've begun to serialize those. I'll break them down into 600 to 800 word posts. It's a way that I can feed my thoughts in relatively small bites to people and to a reasonably sized audience. So the last couple of weeks, I've had a five-day series on Medicare. Then I had a five-day series on import safety. I've got one coming on value-driven health care. I've got one on information technology. You'll see one on health diplomacy and a whole series of other topics. So I'm writing speeches, serializing them, and then putting them out on the blog. Frankly, I think they're probably more widely read than if I handed somebody the booklet and asked them to sit down and look and read the whole thing. I'm also beginning to pick up hits, I think, from people searching specific topics that otherwise might not get my speeches. I've begun to use my blog as a shortcut in communications. Again, something I hadn't expected. When I email people on a subject, I will often now include a link to a blog that I have written. Or occasionally when I'll talk to a reporter, I will say, well, if you want to know more about what I think, here's a blog. These are my own words. Feel free to quote me in any on this subject and anything that's there. And somehow it feels like a more personal statement, given that I've read it, written it, and it's not just something that's been generated at the department. Well, when do I write? Well, much of my writing, as pointed out, is done on airplanes. It's done when I'm in hotel rooms as I travel. It's quiet, and it's a way to pass the time. Several of my blogs have been written on a Stairmaster, bobbing up and down in the gym. I have a lot of them that start off as Blackberries to myself as I drive somewhere after having had some experience. These are not literary masterpieces. I do not expect to be awarded a Pulitzer Prize on the basis of my writing. That isn't my goal. My goal is just to get some rational thoughts down on a hard drive somewhere. And I've found this is a very effective way to do it. Well, what do I write about? Well, frankly, I just write about anything that's on my mind. I tend to focus in this way on matters that are related to my job because it's a government website. One of the things I like about it is that I choose the topic, not a reporter. I choose the words, not a reporter. It is unfiltered. It's a way for me just to say what's on my mind. I sometimes use it for policy analysis. Here's one I wrote on SCHIP. There's a website my son showed me called HowStuffWorks.com. I don't think what I write about today is going to be found there. However, my thoughts fit into that category. I want to explain how one provision of the SCHIP bill that the president vetoed would have worked and why we insisted it be changed. First, let me make a couple of points. Whoever said the devil's in the detail must have been talking about this legislation. The bill was written in consultation with people who knew exactly what their goal was: universal, government-run, taxpayer-financed health care for citizens and for non-citizens alike in the United States. And second, this bill clearly moved multiple steps toward that. So sometimes I use it for policy analysis, where there's something quite detailed that I want to go through and lay out in detail for either my own clarification or for members of Congress or for others, and then I'll use this as a means of being able to spin off. Sometimes I use it to just share an experience. Being a member of the cabinet provides some remarkable experiences. In January, I've spent a part of a weekend on the USS Theodore Roosevelt, and I write about about that experience. Being part of the president's cabinet is becoming acquainted with the broader mission of government, and I accepted an invitation to the USS. I talk about who I met, and I say, hour after hour, planes took off and landed on the deck of the ship. It took off to take off, an aircraft is hooked to a catapult, which uses steam pressure and hydraulics to sling the airplane into the air in less than 2 seconds. It reaches 150 miles an hour. The pilot has engines at full throttle so that the engines take over where the catapult leaves off. Standing just a few feet, I could feel my body vibrate on the inside. It is the kind of force so overpowering that it creates a feeling of smallness. However, the reality of all that steel and the flaming explosives of the jet fuel somehow blends with the controlled methodical motion of the crews. They move with robotic precision over and over. So I try to tell people what I'm experiencing, and somehow I think that may give them some insight into what it's like to be a cabinet secretary. Sometimes I will use it to commemorate. On Martin Luther King Day, I'm a James Taylor fan, I write. His music speaks to me musically and emotionally. The first verse of a song he wrote, Shed a Little Light, has been on my mind today. Let us all turn our thoughts today to Martin Luther King and recognize that there are ties between us, men and women, living on earth, ties of hope and love, sister and brotherhood, that we are bound together. And I go on to relate an experience I had in the 1990s while I was governor of Utah. I was seated next to Coretta Scott King at a dinner in Washington, D.C. Our conversation evolved from a casual dinner chat to a rather long and searching philosophic discussion about Dr. King's life and mission. It was a uniquely personal conversation, and rather than divulge the details, I just want to recount what a gift I felt she gave me that night. I felt like I'd seen a little bit of her soul, and it was moving to me. I then went on to talk about the Medicare prescription drug bus and being in the Ebenezer Baptist Church and having a chance to meet Billy Kiles, who was a respected pastor in Memphis. And he was with Dr. King when he was shot, hearing him tell me personally about that experience. Sometimes I use my blog to send a message. April. 2008. I'm in the Jakarta airport, just finished a day of meetings with the Indonesian government officials, and I go through to detail who they are. I finished the blog. There are some situations that, despite our best efforts, we just can't resolve. In some cases, we live with the added risk. The cost of Indonesia refusing to share influenza samples is incrementally small. However, the damage done by accepting Indonesia's view is profound and simply unacceptable. I'm going to work on this for the next 60 days. If we're unsuccessful, I think time for the world is to accept their unwillingness to participate in the WHO system, and we'll move to other ways of making the world safer. And we're making progress here, but it was important they know how I felt. This was a suitable way for me to share that. Sometimes I use it to just provide a sense of thanks to people. In August, I wrote, for the last year and a half, John Malos, a lieutenant commander of the United States Public Health Service, has coordinated the office of secretary on the road. Starting next month, John's going to be transitioning to a new assignment as the health attaché in Brazil. He'll do a terrific job coordinating the embassy in Brazil, but I'm going to miss him. He anticipates with the acuity of Corporal Radar O'Reilly, and he can take charge like General Patton. Sometimes it's just a very good journal for me. I look back over the last year, and this is undoubtedly the best journal that I've kept. This one written in Mozambique in 2007. I walked down a dirt pathway dividing crude houses made of sticks and mud bricks. I had just looked at a site of a prospective Millennial Challenge Corporation funded water project that will eliminate standing water and the malaria-carrying mosquitoes that come with it. We were 30 minutes ahead of schedule, so I decided to take an unplanned walk through the middle of an African hamlet. My attention was drawn to a vacant chair sitting among a group of women in front of a small closet-like store. I asked if I could sit down. They signaled their approval. Before I could speak, one of the women said through an interpreter, "We're mourning the loss of my daughter. She died on Saturday. Our conversation revealed that she died in childbirth." I provided what comfort I could and moved deeper into the neighborhood. A dozen children scampered around me as I walked, excited about these mostly white strangers. Adults looked up from whatever they were doing, startled and curious. One of them was a pretty woman standing next to a little boy about 3 years old. I asked to meet the little boy. "His father died a few months ago," she said. I offered my second condolence in 100 feet and asked if he was her only child. "No, I have 5. I was surprised. She didn't look old enough. As we talked, it seemed evident her husband had died from AIDS, leaving her alone to carry the heavy cost of this pandemic. I didn't ask, but I wondered if she, like so many others that I had seen on this trip, had been infected by a spouse, compounding the tragedy. I moved on. Sometimes I use it to make announcements. Sometimes I'll use it to respond to a critic. Other times I'll just have something I want to say. Here's one a couple of weeks ago. This morning I had a delightful telephone conversation with Ted Kennedy. He called to talk about health care of others in his state, a subject on which he has expressed passion to me many times. He sounded great. He talked briefly about his health. He was forward-looking, crisp, and passionate, as always. There wasn't a single hint of negativity or worry. I'm sure he has moments when both creep in, but the call was an unexpected lift to my spirit. So who reads my blog? My mother? Not my children? They tend to be people, at least by my observation, who have an interest in health. Many times I think they just stumble onto it looking on the HHS page. Occasionally I think they'll find their way through it through a Google search. I think there are a lot of people inside HHS that read the blog, want to figure out what's going on the sixth floor. I see evidence that occasionally there are reporters that read it. I know that the foreign governments that I work with read it. I think occasionally congressional staff read it. So how do we handle comments? Frankly, I was uneasy about this at the beginning. And I think the people who work around me were even more uneasy. So we decided to offer basically a monitored blog where people submit comments and then they are posted. We've been at it a year, and it's I believe we have had one comment. I'm told there are 3 comments through a signal I got from the front row. And I think we're in the 600 or 700 range now, so it's a very small group. And frankly, I'm quite impressed by the thoughtfulness of the comments. They are, most of them, coming from medical professionals who have thought through and take a lot of time and write their thoughts. I will say that one of the disappointments I have had, and one of the ways in which this has not met my expectation, is that I envisioned I'd have a chance to respond to many more than I have. And I know the blog would be better if I could. But the truth is, I'm doing the best I can to just get posts made, and occasionally I'll sit down at lunch and I'll try to pick out 2 or 3 and respond, but I can't get it done. So you just do what you can do. Now, I've thought about and may try actually having somebody at HHS pick some out and make clear that they are responding on my behalf, not to necessarily respond, but to give information where they may have asked for information and make it kind of a constituency affairs effort. But I'm undecided about that, and I'll be interested to see what you think. So how candid am I in this? Well, frankly, I'm fairly guarded. I think I'm more personal in this than I would be typically with a reporter, but I don't write things I would be uncomfortable with a reporter writing. This is a good tool. It needs to be encouraged. It needs to be, and I suspect that if it were otherwise, and it began to draw a lot of critics, it would diminish its value. But I speak my mind. I'm just not reckless about it. I mentioned I often will send it out to other people to take a look. There have been times when I have sought their opinion, and they have come back with a, "Are you sure you want to say this?" And I have generally found that they were right. And so when I say it's not vetted, it's my choice. I send it out to who I want to, and they've typically given me very good advice. So what have I learned about blogging? Again, I am not a professional blogger. I'm learning as I go. I've learned that shorter is better. At first, I was writing these long tomes that I was pretty sure, after a while, nobody was reading the full extent of, other than my mother. And I've learned that interaction is the key. And I will also say I've been surprised at how willing people are to share with me their thoughts about how I could improve it. I've been taken under the wing of some more seasoned bloggers, and they have helped me learn. Has the interaction with the comments made a difference? I read the comments. I can't respond to all of them, but I read almost all of them at some point. And as I mentioned, I think they're very good thoughts, and there are several times when someone has said something to me that I have felt compelled to pursue further inside the department. There have been times when someone has made an argument to me that I found compelling that I am sure began to mold and shape my thinking. So I do think that in terms of interacting with people, I'm getting quite valuable information. Now, frankly, some of the blogs I see in the broader, less specialized fields where you get a lot of people just being harsh and critical, people who are attempting to see who can be the harshest and most critical. This is different, and I'm glad for that. And I think that was what I was afraid of when I started. When I say afraid of, I was nervous it might turn into, and so we used this monitored blog effort. And it's turned out to be, I think, quite good. And it has not, 3 out of 600 or so is not, I think, a heavy degree of, quote, censorship. Do I expect that blogs are going to be a significant part of public policy in government in the future? Absolutely. How? I think we're all figuring that out. I hope that this is a way in which I can be in touch with lots of people in which they can have a better insight into my thinking. I think that will I continue to write a blog after I complete my public service? It'll just depend on the circumstances, but I like it, and I find it a valuable tool, and so I expect I'll do some of it somehow. We live in an era when information has made a basic change. It used to be we would go to libraries and universities because that's where they stored and passed on and enhanced information. In the information age, information goes where people are, and public policy makers need to do the same. Now, with that, I think we've got just a few minutes to answer your questions, and I'm happy to respond to them. Yes?
Well, just to open it up, will you blog this, and or have you already? And on a slightly more serious vein, would you call it a bloggy pulpit?
I've never been that clever. Have I blogged this? Actually, I haven't, but I probably will. And periodically I have evaluated my own blogging success or lack thereof. I have reported on the things I have learned, and I'll likely report on some of the things I've learned today from preparing this. Yes.
Would you be in favor of having others in your department also blog in some of the other operating divisions?
Well, this is a really interesting question. One of the things that's unique about the secretary of a department is that he or she, by definition, is the spokesperson for that department. And quite frankly, there is a need for a department to have a spokesperson. And if suddenly we ended up with 67,000 spokespersons, that would be a problem. And so I don't have the... I would say that if a lot of people began having blogs on HHS's website, I think that's big, likely wouldn't work. I'm aware that there are people who have personal blogs, and there are guidelines and rules along which lines those can be. But it's a new set of policy. We've actually wrestled with some of these now, and it's a new set of policy decisions that we'll have to make as a government. I'll go to the back next.
Thank you, Secretary Levin. I appreciate hearing about blogging. I'm hoping you'll give me something to blog about if by answering these questions. Within the last couple of weeks, two highly charged issues have surfaced within HHS, a leaked memo redefining some contraceptive devices as abortion, and a waiver of the annual application procedure for Title V abstinence-only programs. The former will substitute a political definition of when pregnancy begins for the medical judgment of the American Medical Association and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. The latter will, for the first time, ignore Congress's reluctance to make ab-only permanent. It has had 19 short-term extensions, as you know, and Speaker Pelosi said last week that a stronger majority in Congress will likely end it. So potentially this decision would tie the hands of the next administration and promise states money that hasn't been authorized. My questions are, will it be HHS policy that the 98% of Americans who use contraception at some point in their lives are terminating rather than preventing pregnancy? And can you explain why this grant period should be treated differently than the previous 19 short-term extensions for ab-only programs? And thank you very much.
Both thoughtful questions. The reply to both is the same. I do not have anything to add to your blog today. Yes, in the back.
Secretary, in your previous question up here, you were talking about one of the hesitations of getting everybody in the department involved in blogging is that you'd be worried about having 60,000 spokespeople on behalf of the department. Do you view sort of what you're doing as more of a spokesperson role or trying to further the conversation of health policy online?
Well, it's probably both. I mean, there are times when I am speaking as the official spokesperson, making official policy statements, using a blog as the vehicle to do that. I think you can expect that there are other avenues of communication being used at the same time when that occurs. Other times, I am speaking as the spokesperson, but providing tone and texture and color and insight in a way I'm comfortable doing it. Now, as has been pointed out, I don't think every cabinet secretary is doing it. I think there's a good reason for that. Some of them aren't comfortable with it. Some of them may think it's a bad idea. I don't know. It's the reason I said I'm going to do this for 6 weeks. It's now gone to a year. I'm experimenting as I go. I think I feel comfortable with the way I'm balancing those two. Others might not feel comfortable. Yes. Well, lest I offer any commercial endorsements, there are a number that tend to keep coming back to my attention. In many cases, it's because I have interest in the subjects that they write. Now, one of the things that we have done in the last year is we've begun to embrace blogging as a news avenue. And, for example, we have different exercises that we do in emergency preparedness. And we invited all of the traditional media to come in at various points and to actually be part of one of our exercises. It's a very helpful thing because we began to understand what they were looking for. And we asked the blog community to come in and to do the same thing. It was helpful in a very powerful way because we began to see and understand the depth of their sources, how they would, the way they would weigh a story. And when you're dealing with pandemic influenza or some story in a 24-hour worldwide news cycle, you need to know that. So I've begun to pay a lot more attention to it. And I know that our department has, and we've begun to integrate them, if you will, into the way we utilize news as a tool of communicating outside of our department. I think we've got time for just a couple more. Yes, you and the lady, yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for doing your blog and considering the conversation. Earlier you mentioned about using blogging technology to reach a younger audience, and so I was wondering, how would you recommend going about that to reach teens or young adults? Because the pandemic flu blog that you mentioned is kind of a different tool, and it was a short-term, multi-author blog. So what are some of the ideas that or strategies you might recommend?
Well, I just think there are very few teens reading my blog. Can't even get my own son to look at it, but... Nor will he let me look at his MySpace page. I don't know what that means, but this goes back to what we started off with. We have to figure out how to use these tools to reach audiences that desperately need and deserve to have what we have to offer them. Obesity is an epidemic that is spreading not just across this country but across the world, and it is being engendered by a generation that is not being, is not reachable by the old means. So those of us who are in charge of public policy need to reach out and ask them to help us figure out how to reach them. This idea of YouTube, the CDC effort with the avatar, using texting, the kinds of, those are the things we're learning. We're in the early stages of trying to figure out, and the reason that it's such a valuable thing to have the Kaiser Family Foundation sponsor this event. One more question, then I should wrap up. Yes, sir.
How often, if at all, does a journalist start a line of questioning by, "I read on your blog this week"? In other words, is it a way in which you sort of seed the conversation with the journalist class?
Increasingly, which pleases me. Frankly, I'm flattered that they would read my blog. And I'm also pleased because it does begin to seed the conversation and allows them to know in more depth than we can typically get in the 2 or 3 minute interview that we get to have what I'm thinking. And I hope more journalists will read it, not because it's great writing, but just because I think it enhances the capacity of public policy figures to communicate well. I think this is all part of the change that we're all experiencing. It's the change of a information-based global economy. I say it almost every speech at the conclusion, something that I believe is a foundation of my service, and that is this. There are only three ways you can deal with change in a marketplace like we're dealing with today. The first is you can fight it and fail. This is the way information is going to be moving about. So we need to get used to it and get on with it. The second, you can accept it and survive. Or finally, you can lead and prosper. This is the United States of America. Let us lead and continue to prosper. Thank you.
I'm on now. There we go. Thank you. And so now we're going to move to the panel discussion. So I'm going to ask the panelists to come on up and take their places up here. So it's my pleasure to introduce to you our panelists for today, starting with Michael Cannon. Michael Cannon is the Cato Institute's Director of Health Policy Studies and a former domestic policy analyst for the Senate Republican Policy Committee. He's a frequent contributor to the Cato at Liberty blog, which I've put up here on the screen. And you can see this recent post here where he just happens to be taking aim at another one of our panelists, Ezra Klein. Ezra Klein is an associate editor at the American Prospect, where he focuses on social policy, on health care, and the politics of legislative reform. He started his first blog in 2003 and has been associated with a number of different ones over the years until he founded his current blog, Ezra Klein, which you can see here in a post that just happens to be citing none other than Michael Cannon. And who said it's an insular world? Oh, okay. Okay, column.
It's all also right. Not Michael Cannon.
Jacob Goldstein is a staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal and the lead writer for their health blog, which he helped create in 2007. And here you can see an example of his writing where he just happens to be writing about Healthcare for All's John McDonough. And John McDonough was recently named senior advisor to Senator Edward Kennedy on national health reform. Prior to that, he spent 5 years as executive director of Healthcare for All, which is the consumer health advocacy organization that was very active in the Massachusetts health reform debate and where blogging in particular was an active part of their role there. And here is one that just happens to be talking about Ezra Klein. And Tom Rosensteel designed the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism, and he directs its activities. He also serves as vice chair of the Committee of Concerned Journalists, and he was a journalist himself for more than 20 years, including media critic for the LA Times and chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek. And he is the editor and principal author of PEJ's annual report on the state of the news media, which is a comprehensive report that I'm sure you're all familiar with, on the state of American journalism. All right, so I wanted to start today with basically asking each of you why it is that you blog. What are your goals with your blog, and why is a blog in particular the appropriate way to meet those goals? And I thought I would start with you, Jacob Goldstein. You are the most, you represent the most traditional journalism model, I guess, of anybody up here on the panel. What was your paper's mandate to you with your blog, and you know, what are you accomplishing, and why is blogging the appropriate way to do that?
Well, I think the basic impulse behind launching the blog and writing the blog is the same as the basic impulse for having the newspaper, which is to explain the world, in this case to explain health and the business and finance aspects of health to people in as clear and fair and insightful a way as possible. A boring answer has the advantage of being somewhat true. There are particular things, you know, about the blog, I think, that make it different and that made the journal want to launch the blog. They hired me a year and a half ago or so to help create it. A big part of that, I think, was reaching out into the web more. The journal's, you know, the sort of newspaper site of the journal has been basically a subscription model, which by its nature tends to be more apart from the web. The blog is free, and we link all the time to stories in other papers. So, I mean, while it's true, like you were saying in the introduction, there can be insular things about it. I think, you know, newspapers have traditionally had a very, a notion of, you know, if we didn't report it, mm-hmm. it's not happening. And there is certainly some value to that. At the same time, I think it can be useful for readers to say, well, here all these, you know, reliable, established media outlets are saying these interesting things that might be of use to you. Oh, and here's something else that we know about this that might help add to what you might read somewhere else.
So in a way, you're aggregating more content for your readers than you could do in if you were just writing in print?
Certainly. Aggregation, I think, is one of the big services that the blog provides.
Are you reaching people who aren't print subscribers, you think?
Yes. I mean, certainly. You know, I don't have any way of knowing exactly who is reading what, but there are people who come to the journal's website who are not print subscribers. There are also people who come to individual blog posts from other places, like from Google News or from other blogs that link to our blog, and I suspect that many of them are indeed not readers of the print paper.
Okay. Ezra Klein, so you're also a professional journalist, but you've been a blogger kind of as your primary thing that you've done for a while. Take a pretty different approach, I would say, than Jacobs. There's a lot more, you're wider ranging in terms of the topics that you cover and a little more eclectic. By the way, I loved your recipe for grilled bread and tomato salad. That was great.
Thank you. We started on Mark Bittman's blog.
Oh, okay. So tell us why, you know, what's your goal with your blog and why is blogging the best way to reach that?
Well, sure. As Vicky says, I think I'm a bit different than folks on this panel in that I came to other forms of media through blogging. My first panel about being a blogger was in 2003. And back then, it was people sort of looking at me in a room, asking me how to spell the word blog. And now you come here, and you've got a cabinet secretary, an advisor to Senator Kennedy, a Wall Street Journal reporter, which is to say that the medium itself has undergone a pretty profound transformation. And the transformation is that blogging is no longer its own thing, with a specialized group of content producers and a sort of definable mission. It's now just another medium. People on this panel, they write magazine articles, newspaper op-eds, journal articles, and also they blog. And so like any other medium, it has found an audience because it solves a problem that the other mediums couldn't solve. And to show you what the problem is, I have a prop, which is a special report from my magazine. And if I hold it up like this, people in the back, I don't think can see it. It's probably virtually 2D. But it's very thin. My magazine, The American Prospect, comes out 10 times a year. 64 pages a time. It's a political niche magazine, which means, you know, it's got a niche. It is a topic focus, but it has to cover a lot of things: the election, healthcare, the economy, Iraq. We have a culture section in the back, which is trickier to fill. And what blogging, and within those 64 pages, I can maybe convince my editors, who are, you know, pretty well disposed to me writing long, boring articles about healthcare, to let me write about 4 long, boring articles about healthcare a year. But more than that, and we turn into a niche publication only for healthcare, and we lose a lot of our readership. On the blog, there's no scarcity of pages. The only scarcity is content. What the blog allows me to do is write as much about as many things as I want to a day, and that allows me to become a different type of writer. I can have a niche and also be a generalist. I can have readers who come because they want political commentary. Obama's extremely neat. I like to cook. But I also have readers who come for the healthcare. And the two things actually end up cross-pollinating. So people who wouldn't be coming to a niche healthcare blog end up learning a lot about healthcare. And people who would be coming to a niche healthcare blog end up learning about things I cook on the weekends. And so that ends up allowing me to have a much broader audience and addressing a much sort of wider array of topics, both within and without healthcare, and allows me to be much more in conversation. And I find that that's good for comprehension. As a magazine writer, I like doing long-form journalism more than any other type of journalism. But the problem with it is if, you know, despite my great talent, I write one paragraph that's a little bit opaque, I can't tell my reader what I meant. And on the blog, it's an endless conversation that things they don't understand can be come back. You can come back to the next day. So, I mean, I will say that I think that, you know, for all the mediums I do participate in, and this would be my sort of overall answer to why do I blog, you know, I do newspaper op-eds and magazines, and I've done a bit of TV, but that I think the blog is actually the best for creating a relationship and transmitting information to the reader, because you can tailor your approach to exactly what they do and don't need, and you can create a sort of broader world that allows them to be a little bit less into it than you are, but still retain their interest.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Michael Cannon, you blog from a totally different perspective. You're a policy researcher and analyst. And so how, you know, why do you blog, and what purpose does that serve?
Well, I work for the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank. We have ideals that we want to promote, and we want to convince people that those are the right ideals. And so we do all sorts of things to try to achieve that. We host forums like this one. We hold or we publish books and studies. We go on broadcast media, we write op-eds. So when blogs came on the scene, someone said, maybe we should try this thing. And I don't know if I had heard of a blog until they told me that we were going to launch one. And I asked, what is it? And they said, you can just sort of say whatever you want for as long as you want to the world. Sounds like a pretty good deal to me. So, so we launched that as another way of getting our ideas out before the thinking public. And I think it's been very successful doing that. It's not just about health policy. We write about all sorts of ideas. And it's a wonderful way to educate those who consider themselves libertarian about the finer points of our worldview, to educate people who are curious about libertarianism, about how this worldview operates, and educate people who are hostile to it about how they're wrong.
Do you think you get people who are hostile to libertarianism going to the blog?
Well, obviously, I mean, Ezra Klein goes to the blog, and so it serves a lot of purposes. It also allows us to comment a lot quicker than we could if we had to gin up a press release. Mm-hmm. It allows us to respond in a much briefer format than we would be able to if we had to write an entire op-ed.
And John McDonough, similarly, in Massachusetts, it was sort of part of the conversation around health care reform. Why did your organization want to be reaching people through the blog, and how did it work out?
We started in April 2005 when Massachusetts health reform was in the legislative process pretty deeply, and we wanted a way to compensate for the incredibly shrinking news hole in the daily media, which permitted only a much more superficial treatment of what was going on. We thought that there was an audience. We thought it would be an organizational enhancement. It would be something that would increase our public profile and would enhance the organization's objectives. And we thought it was a way to get our point of view across. We found increasingly that less so much getting our point of view across and almost becoming kind of the essential daily diary of Massachusetts health reform. Mm. So if something was in the Wall Street Journal or the Times or the Globe or the Herald and someone didn't see it, this was the place where you'd go and you'd stitch all those pieces together. If there were documents that became available, we could put them up there on our website very mm-hmm. easily. And so it became a great boost for the organization, a great way to communicate, and to create a community of interest. And also to create, and we have kind of really an uncensored approach to the poster, so people come on and throw pies in our face all the time. And it's a nice way to have a conversation, because a lot of times people throw pies just because they disagree, and sometimes because they get some factually incorrect information. And so it's a way, then, if one person has that incorrect information, a lot of people do, and it's a way to try to put out some other ways of understanding what's going on and correct misimpressions that are out there in the policy world.
So we had an inquiry from somebody who's watching the live webcast kind of along these lines. Mary Foxworth writes, do you think that blogs influence either public opinion or lawmakers' opinion? When you did that blog, do you think you changed anybody's opinion and either in the public or policymakers?
I think we draw attention to certain important sources of information. We draw attention to topics and research and news stories that folks might have missed that have relevance, that are important. If a public agency puts out a study that doesn't get covered very well, we can highlight it and get the word out there. And so we think it does have an influence and is a way of talking. In general, I think people inside government are not heavy consumers of blogs. I think the secretary, and I really salute him for the work that he's been doing putting it out there, is really an anomaly. I don't think there are a lot of folks mm-hmm. who do it. And I don't think there are a huge number of folks inside government who are heavy consumers. I've been doing my own random survey mm-hmm. of it since I got to the Senate. And I think we're more indirect consumers of it because people in those positions have so many heavy sources of information bombarding them every day
yeah.
and just don't have, frankly, a lot of time on their hands to right. surf the web and look at what's new there.
All right. Tom Rosensteel, you have spent more time sort of looking at the news business and than probably anybody here. Can you take a step back for us and give us a sense of where online news fits in the big picture of news consumption in this country and blogs in particular, where they fit?
Sure. First of all, I think it's when I think of blogs, I think blogs are like muffins. They range from everything from bran to chocolate cake. They're more of a shape than they are defining a particular kind of content. And I think that the point that they put you in the conversation and tonally, there's a similarity to blogs, and obviously they tend to have posts, links, and comments. The similarities pretty much end there. Most bloggers that we've seen really see themselves as activists, not speaking to the world at large, but speaking to somebody here that called it the thinking public. I tend to think of themselves as soldiers in an army, whatever, a lot of different armies out there. If you look at what blogs are about, the largest of them are about people's lives and experiences. They're personal blogs, they're little diaries. Politics and government is the second biggest topic. 11% of blogs are about that. Then you have entertainment, sports, news and current events at 5%, business at 5%. So it's a smattering of different things, and most and the largest chunk are personal. You know, my knitting, my hobbies, my this, my that. If the secretary, when he stops being secretary and he just starts writing about what he did that day, he'll fall into the life and experiences category. Where do blogs fit in the constellation of journalism, and where does online fit in the constellation of journalism? Well, journalism is moving online.
Right.
If you look at the demographics, particularly the age demographics of the audience, the legacy media's audience is aging and eventually is going to die off. And young people consume their news differently. They consume it when they consume what they want, when they want it. They are an on-demand generation, and they get their news online. In 25 years, will there be print newspapers? I don't know. Right now, they survive because that's where the revenue is.
But the readership of the audience for news is much more in print and on television than it is online at this point, right?
Yes, but it is shifting. I mean, major newspapers have roughly half their readership now online. And the top websites are generating 25, 30 million unique visitors a month. You know, that's, let's say, a million visitors a day. That does not compare to 6 million viewers of the worst-rated nightly newscast.
Right.
So, yes, but those lines are eventually going to meet. The problem and the real impact of this migration of the audience to the Internet is that the Internet doesn't have a revenue model that works.
Right.
So as the audience migrates, the advertiser is not migrating along with them, and that's having a devastating effect on the news business. It's not loss of audience, in other words, that's harming the business, and it's not a loss of audience to blogs. The people who read blogs, by and large, are heavy news consumers. The function that blogs play in this universe is they've taken the conversation that begins after people read the news and extends it out beyond the editorial pages to a much broader audience. So traditional news isn't disappearing. It's shoving over some of its shelf space to allow blogs to create a much more dynamism and variety to the conversation that follows the news.
Well, let's talk about the audience and readership. There's a fair number of health policy-related blogs out there, or blogs that touch on that subject. But do we know if anybody's reading them, or if everybody's just talking to each other? What do you guys know about your readership, who they are, and how many they are? Why don't we start with you, Chick?
I'm pretty confident that more people read the blog that I write than read Secretary Leavitt's blog. The journal doesn't disclose traffic for the blog, but I do it basically full time, and there is an editor who devotes much of his time to it. And the traffic is enough, I hope, so far to keep it going. In terms of who, it's written with a bit more of an insider take, perhaps, than the journal as a whole. So it tends to be physicians and people who work in health policy and people who work in the pharmaceutical industry, although certainly we write plenty of posts and get plenty of readers who are of a more general audience.
Mm-hmm. Asher?
The last time I saw my flight statistics, because our IT department has them, was in June. So this has probably been inflated from the primary, but I got then about 50,000 uniques a week is what, and I'm not a particularly big blog. So you're not going to have folks who are getting 6 million a day like a nightly newscast, but something like Daily Coast, which is not a health policy blog, granted, but you're talking 500,000 people a day. And, I mean, this is just exponential growth within a very short period of years. So if you just look at the trends there, I think they're pretty big. And you have to also remember that one thing that's sort of unique to blogging is that a post has a lifespan beyond where it's originally published. It gets quoted and mm-hmm. reprinted elsewhere. So a post of mine may end up on Huffington in their politics section, which would give it another X number of readers. So it can be a little bit hard to measure, but it's been a sort of remarkable amount of growth. As for who it is, youngish, not as young as people may think, but generally 30 to 40, affluent office workers, people, the time people actually check blogs is between 11 and 1 in the morning, or not 1 a.m., but 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. in the mid-morning to afternoon. It's when they've gotten to work, returned their emails, and gotten bored again. And that's what I'm there for.
I like it. So it's a lunch hour activity, kind of, which is great.
I think employers would like it more if it were just a lunch hour activity. So.
Okay. Tom.
A survey last year found that 15% of adults said that they read a blog daily, and 28% did so monthly, which is a big number, but, you know, it's not, it doesn't compare with the, you know, 90% that are
consuming
social news.
How about here in the audience? Why don't we, I'm going to turn to you for questions in just a second, but also could I just see a show of hands of how many people read blogs daily? That looks to me to be probably about half, a little more maybe. Okay, and how many of you read it through like an RSS reader? Fair number. Okay. So one of the controversies about healthcare blogging in particular was during the SCHIP debate and what happened with the Frost family whose son spoke in the radio address and so on. E.J. Dionne quoted the blogger, Sean Mullen, from The Moderate Voice, as saying that the targeting of the Frost family, quote, reveals the vicious underbelly of the blogosphere. And I wanted to see if any of you here have an opinion about whether that's right or not. I mean, is there something that is unique about blogs that played a part in what happened in that instance that wouldn't have or couldn't have happened through some other medium, just through talk radio or something like that? Anybody have any thoughts on that? Michael?
Well, if a person is nasty, I think it's easier for them to get a wider audience with a blog than maybe with a traditional media. You know, you can't get through an editor if you submit an op-ed to the newspaper about the Frosts. They're not going to let you be nasty to them. They're going to screen that much more carefully. So I think you'll probably you get more people just going off half cocked on blogs than you do on traditional media, to be sure.
I think the thing that irks me the most are the people who post comments anonymously and get very personal and very negative. You can't do that with letters to the editor. You have to sign and they check to see that you really did say it and you are who you are. And so I think that's one of the parts. I think there's a tone and a politeness thing that certainly standards decline pretty quickly.
Although you wouldn't necessarily have to say who you were if you were calling into a talk radio station.
Clearly,
either.
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's right.
And there ends up being a bit of a performance aspect. I mean, what Sean is talking about there, I was a bit involved in that fight, and he's talking about the fact that a right-wing blogger named Michelle Malkin
went to the house of the Frost family and asked their neighbors about their income. Mm-hmm. And this, to a lot of people, seemed excessive to do to a child who'd been in a car accident. And that's a problem, but it's a familiar pressure. Michelle Malkin makes a living off of her blog. She runs a very sensationalistic, very vituperative blog. And she realized she would get a lot more hits if she did the most extreme thing possible. It's something we see in a lot of media. Stand in the grocery checkout aisle and check out the mm-hmm. pictures people are taking of celebrities. Some of them seem a little bit invasive, but it can happen in blogs, but I think it's more familiar than people may give it credit for.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I think that's an interesting raises an interesting question. Michelle Malkin is Michelle Malkin, but if an investigative journalist did the same thing, went to the neighbor's house and asked about their income, would it be quite as distasteful? Or if a left wing blogger went to Leona Helmsley's neighbor's house and asked, you know, do you think she's, you know, what can you tell me about her lifestyle and whether she's been sheltering income? Would that be as distasteful? I'm not as sure that is necessarily distasteful for a blogger to be doing things that, you know, a traditional journalist would, you know, is expected to do as a matter of course.
So the topic I wanted to turn to is, you know, is blogging news and how is it impacting the news business? And there's a couple of folks I wanted to quote here. So Mark Ambender said recently that he doesn't deserve credit for, quote unquote, reporting things in his blog because blog items aren't researched or vetted. As he put it, it's just a couple of keystrokes, not really news. Bill Walsh, former D.C. correspondent for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, said the other day that the number of bloggers commenting on the news out of Washington has exploded. The number of reporters actually digging up the news has dwindled. And Jonathan Alter, in his column this week, says, blogs are indispensable aggregators of political news, but we're finding this works better for keeping on top of daily flaps than for learning genuinely new information. I mean, what are your thoughts on blogs as a source of news versus sort of opinion or aggregation?
Well, when we've done content analysis, you think your job is tedious, content analysis of blogs, we found that very, very few of them had any content in there that was repertorial. By repertorial, we meant that they talked to someone, interviewed someone, unearthed information. There was a second level of passing information along that was somewhat more prevalent, where people might cite data and things like that. But by far, the larger activities in blogs were people reading something in traditional media and talking about it, or making a point about what they thought was missing in the traditional media, or trying to bring something new to the agenda. But it wasn't observational, and it was not repertorial in nature. It was conversational. Which is a vital role. I mean, journalism in the end is conversation among citizens. That's its goal. But this is sort of, as I said before, kind of a second level activity that occurs after the news reporting.
Yeah, although as you point out, there are so many different blogs that it's like it is not the same thing. If you talk about print, is it the Weekly World Reader and the New York Times?
Yeah, most newspapers now have staff-written blogs, and those tend to be actually sort of an informal version of a story that we either ran yesterday or is about to run tomorrow. That's almost a subset.
I was just speaking with Brian Hartman, who is a producer at ABC World News Tonight, and he said that in his field, blogs are constantly breaking new news. I mean, that he sees blogs breaking stories on health safety, on the pharmaceutical industry, and so on, that there are a few folks who have great expertise in this area and have a particular niche who, when something comes along in that field, they're way out ahead of a reporter who might have to be covering a whole bunch of different aspects of the healthcare field. Yeah, Jacob?
Well, I mean, that's certainly the case at the Journal, and a number of beat reporters who are not bloggers have come to see, I think, the value of the blog in getting documents and in getting stories out there and published quickly, or stories that might not be quite right for the paper, or stories for any number of reasons that can find a proper home on the blog. And it's a very useful tool in that way for reporters and for readers.
Yes, John.
Yeah, one of the key advantages of a blog over a regular newspaper is the ability to link.
Mm-hmm.
We, in Massachusetts, in the summer of 06, after health reform passed, the state has to report financial statements to Wall Street on a pretty regular basis for their bond-selling purposes. And they regularly, in these documents, would talk in great detail about some of the financial details of Massachusetts health reform that weren't available anywhere. And these were exclusive, and you need a subscription to get to it. And so we got a little mole who got us a connection to it. And so we printed the whole document online,
mm-hmm.
and made it available to the public in a way that wasn't available. And then the new administration we got them to agree they should just make these things public anyway for the public. But so there is that ability, and that you just can't get with a newspaper, where you can talk on the story and then you can link to the source document, which is just an extraordinary advantage.
Right, but that's an advantage to any online news site, not particular to blogging.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'd add in that I think this is, to speak on your point of it's not particular to blogging, I think this is one of those places where the distinctions between blogging and all other media is increasingly dissolving.
Mm-hmm.
I think the relative measure doesn't do us a whole lot of good, because the correct comparison would be all writing, because blogs include people who are writing, you know, diaries on MySpace. But if you're just sort of looking at political blogs, there's been an exploding professionalization of the blogosphere. And you mentioned Mark Ambiter. Being modest, he's broken a tremendous number of stories. His colleagues at the Politico, Ben Smith and Jonathan Martin, who are doing campaign reporting on blogs, Ben Smith has broken, I'd argue, more stories in Democratic primary than anyone else has in sheer numbers. Adam McGurney at the New York Times blogs, they have the Caucus blog, the Washington Post has the Trail blog. TPM Muckraker has a whole investigative operation, the Washington Independent is, and you can sort of just go on down the line. What's happening is that journalists are being funded to blog, and eventually it's just one more place, and so the question will be how many journalists you have working in the media, because just about all of them are going to be putting some effort towards a blog, or a whole lot of them will. I don't think there will be for much longer a tension between reporting done in newspapers and reporting done on blogs, because I think the trends are overwhelmingly to reporting just simply being done in both places and published in the medium that makes the most sense.
And sometimes it's hard to tell what's a blog and what's just an online article. I've got a question from somebody who sent it in via email, and then think about your questions. I'll be calling on people here. So Ron Hammerly from Tampa, Florida, chairman of Health Resources Limited, says, can the panelists share one specific example where a blog has changed their thinking on a health policy issue?
Michael. I can, and I'm glad for the question, because I think that at its best, health policy blogging can help us arrive faster at the truth of what's going to make us all healthier and wealthier. And, of course, there are different perspectives on that. And I think one example of that is an exchange that I've had with Ezra. Ezra's actually changed my thinking, you know, a little bit. There have been arguments that I used to make for my position that Ezra has very reasonably dissected and said, you know what, this doesn't quite say what you think it's saying, and so I've abandoned those. So I think that at its best, health policy blogging can do that. At its, well, I was not going to say it's worse. At its worst would be that ad hominem stuff, but it doesn't reach its full potential if all we're doing is preaching to the choir transmitting to people who already agree with us. I think that it can achieve a lot of good if we get that kind of cross-pollinization.
Anybody else have their opinion changed ever by a blog?
Just some of the commentators post, some of the people who reply to some of our postings,
mm-hmm.
Insurance brokers, folks really down in the weeds in terms of Massachusetts healthcare, coming forward and giving some specific examples of things that they're actually seeing going
mm-hmm.
on, some positive, some, you know, not so positive, is very, very helpful.
Okay. Anybody in the audience? Yeah, over there. Go ahead.
Thanks.
Can you please identify yourself?
Sure. Here? My name is Mark Senek, and I read a blog called IONFDA. One of the things that is a barrier to breaking news is if you're not a professional journalist writing a blog, is getting credentialed into an event. Have any of you faced a barrier in terms of credentialing? And that's one part. But the other part is really, should there be some credentialing standard for those writing blogs?
Well, one of the traditional standards for getting credentialed, let's say, in the press galleries on the Hill is that your publication takes advertising. So places like ProPublica, which are foundation funded and are having trouble meeting that criteria, when in the writing of the Shield Law, they're trying to figure out, well, what blogging should be protected under a Shield Law and what shouldn't. And so they're really trying to get closer to the notion of what's the nature of the content, the nature of the work, because the idea that you're part of the working press or that you get advertising or that you're part of a large company, the usual sort of accoutrement that defines something as press isn't working anymore.
Can you just hang on for a microphone that will be coming to you? Right to your right.
Sorry.
Okay.
I just wanted to point out there's an organization called the Media Bloggers Association that actually works with governmental agencies and with blogs and with companies that actually tries to help them secure credentialing for bloggers. And they vet bloggers for all the appropriate vetting credentials.
Other questions? Yes.
I'm Nancy Ray from the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments. Could you make some comments on the demographics of the blogosphere? Today we seem to have white males. And what is the role of blogging? You mentioned it doesn't work if you're only preaching to the choir. How can it work to break down some of the stovepiping or demographic differences in the country?
Somebody? I'm going to say Ezra. You've been blogging the longest.
Okay. I could say that I found that blogging is enormously open to young white males. It's been extremely, it has no gates if you're that. This is a conversation that has been tremendously controversial and long-running in the blogosphere. And blogging does tilt male. It does tilt white. It does not tilt those two things as much as one would expect, but this is getting out of health policy blogging, but it's the only way I know how to answer it. The great problem in blogging for diversity purposes is that you've had a strange dynamic in which I'm just called a political blogger, despite the fact that I do a lot of healthcare, but a female political blogger, take my friend Jill Filipovic, who writes a blog called Feministe, she would be, you know, she writes about the election, she writes about healthcare sometimes, but she would be considered a women's issues blogger. Similarly, we just hired someone at the American Prospect, a guy named Adam Serwer, went to Columbia Journalism School, an amazingly talented young writer. He wrote a blog called Two Cents, but he's African-American and was considered, because a lot of his commentary talked about race, an African-American blogger. So there's a problem of sorting people such that they don't get invited to panels and aren't considered sort of the broader political blogosphere, which is tremendously destructive. I don't have an answer for it, but what I would say is that it is a problem, but it isn't a problem because there aren't those writers in existence in the blogosphere. The problem is much more, you know, who gets the invites, who Daily Coast links to, who's read by which communities, and sort of what that means for the modes of transmission of their product and publicity for their own sort of persona.
Tom?
Yeah, one factor here is probably audience, and I've got some data that we haven't released yet, but the audience for blogs and for sort of online activity, particularly people who lean more online than not, they are younger, but they skew male. They are very heavily educated. This is an elite, blogging is an elite activity for an elite audience, by and large. And that, you know, the audience always tends to influence who does the content. It's a fish and egg thing.
Okay. I've got a question that came in from email, and then I'll go back to the audience.
I work for the United Nations HIV and AIDS News Service, Plus News. We're currently experimenting with a blog on HIV/AIDS, but a lot of our journalists struggle with the shift in voice, putting themselves in their writing a bit more in terms of experiences, opinion, and so on. How would you bloggers advise journalists who are not used to writing in the blog medium to make the transition?
Well, I mean, so I was a newspaper reporter before I was a blogger. I think it's possible to write in a sort of bloggier tone without, you know, talking about what you had for breakfast. I mean, just writing like you speak, writing like if you get excited about a story and tell the reporter sitting in the next cube why you think it's interesting, and use that language, I think that ends up being very good language for a blog.
Okay. Other questions from the audience? Yes, right here.
Jennifer Burke, Amplify Public Affairs. We've talked today about the health policy blogosphere and a little bit about how that affects policy in general, some political blogging. How does it affect the health blogosphere? How do you interact with patients who are blogging about their conditions? I know there's an enormous diabetes blogosphere. There's an infertility blogosphere. How do you talk to pharmaceutical companies that are blogging? What's the interaction between policy and the sector as a whole?
Oh, as far as I know, I don't interact with them. I'm not aware of any, really. I'm aware that those resources are there and that people are using them and will sometimes comment on them, but I've never had any back and forth.
Well, let me kind of follow up on that a little bit. You know, one of the expectations about blogs, I think, and something that you've written about, Tom, is the role of blogs in giving voice to the citizenry, that anybody can post a blog. But the reality out there, some people say, is maybe more big media, at least the ones that are getting the big audience, and that there's a fair amount of using blogs as a marketing tool, maybe PR reps for companies or marketing for the blogger who might have a book to sell or a consultancy or something like that. How do you think that balances, you know, in terms of how big a part is marketing playing in the blogosphere?
I mean, I think this is a very good point, because what we've caught up here are sort of the best of the best, just an almost idealized version of what a blogger should be, when in fact it also allows, minus the, you know, cultural diversity, obviously. Blogs also, as does the net in general, allows all kinds of people to do viral marketing, to pose. Most bloggers are anonymous still, if you look at the full universe of blogging. So that cuts one way. Another way it cuts is that citizens may have a lot more information that may be misinformation. I don't know how many of you have talked to your doctor and said, I'm feeling symptoms, I take this drug, and the doctor says, get off the internet, please.
Mm-hmm.
And a third thing that happens is that it raises the bar for journalists, because if you're a reporter and you've got 4 days to write a story about some disease, the people who are reading that, if their parents have that disease, they've been on the internet for 2 years, and they know far more than the reporter is going to learn in a week. So all of those currents are working their way. You don't know who's posting this stuff on the internet, and yet you have access to a lot of information that will educate you in different directions.
Okay, John?
You know, our blog at Healthcare for All is a niche blog within a niche within a niche within mm-hmm. a niche. And it's very it's small. It's got maybe about 1,000 readers a day.
Mm-hmm.
And a huge number of those 1,000 folks care passionately about what we're doing. And so it creates a community of folks who are interested, who can learn and exchange from each other on a daily basis. It does. Sometimes it breaks out and gets a larger bit of attention, but most of the time it is that community talking to each other on a day-by-day basis about what's important and what matters. And that's a wonderfully powerful thing, and there is a siloization that happens within the blogosphere just like everybody else, but I think that's generally okay, because there is the accessibility to visit those other places.
Well, let's talk for a second about the influence of blogs on, potentially on policy. And the last time we had a big healthcare reform debate in this country, blogs didn't exist, I don't think. If we have another one in 2009,
how will it be different? Will it be different because of the blogosphere, the existence of blogs or not? And if so, how?
All right. Let me try to think where to begin. Because this is what we think about a lot, the prospect, because our mission to some degree is to actually influence policy, to be, you know, we do journalism, but in a real sense, our audience is extremely select. The mass of our circulation is in the country, but the center of it is here in D.C. And I'd say two things. Number one is feedback. The currency of a blogger and a writer is feedback. And what I mean by that is that it has been an incredible revelation to me what a large percentage of a small blogger's audience are people Googling their own name. When I ran a blog, just 3 months after I began, I had 30 readers, and just one of them happened to run Howard Dean's campaign. It was Joe Trippi, who was sort of, you know, up at 2 a.m. looking for his name online and found some stuff I was writing about his candidate. And this is actually very powerful if you think about how to leverage it. I have really good sources in the policy areas of each campaign because these are powerful people in the campaign. They put a lot of work into what they do. They have large staffs of people. And then they spend 4 months writing the Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, John McCain healthcare plan. And then they release it. And there's a Robert Pair article that doesn't say if they did a good job or not. It just says they released a healthcare plan. And they sort of wait. And then 10 years ago, nothing really happened after that. Maybe there's a New Republic article or an American Prospect article. Now there's this guy, Ezra Klein, writing a whole lot of posts instantly where they get to check on their own performance. They hear criticism. I have my own point of view, so they may take it with a grain of salt. But it is tremendous how much they do hear it. Feedback is the currency of a blogger. And it is remarkable who you can reach just through that. Just so the one other thing I'd say is that I just told the one story about in 94, you know, when Betsy McCoy goes to New Republic, publishes this article, No Exit. And people from the Clinton administration, you know, will tell you that this was A, extremely influential, and B, extremely full of lies. And both those things are, as far as I can tell, correct. But the only thing that they could do was release a press release, which by nature didn't have a whole lot of credibility because they were the Clinton administration. They were trying to sell their policy. It won't be that way this year. The one thing the bloggers are very good at doing is getting the media to notice them. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be extremely influential, even if quietly so, in that conversation. And if something like the McCoy article happens, on either side of the spectrum, the feeding frenzy around it will end up embarrassing the publication more than it will do anything to harm the legislation. So I think there will be a much more careful conversation because there are going to be so many partisans waiting to jump so ferociously on any missteps made by either side.
Interesting. Anybody else want to comment on that?
Just much, much faster. Mm-hmm. Things are going to happen much, much faster. The whole feedback loop and the process. So you have a congressional process which hasn't changed in many ways in 200 years, and but the reaction to it and the policy process around it is just picking up at the speed of light.
Mm-hmm. If nobody else is going to mention that, okay, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say there's also a piece of advice in what Ezra said for those who are trying to build traffic on their own blogs, which is mention other people's blogs. Praise them, criticize them, link to them, because these people do Google their own names, and they will find out that that you're writing about them, and that will drive people there. Especially if you can engage someone and to argue with you or, mm-hmm. about something.
Okay, Tom.
I would say that I think your point about in a debate the role of the blogs being different and particularly potent. One of the things, and it's worth mentioning, that happens is if the media move on to something or move away from something or ignore it altogether, it can have a second life because blogosphere can say, wait a second, this was missed, mm-hmm. this is important, and then the news media that ignored it the first time will go on to it. And that's a very powerful correcting thing. Mm-hmm. The agenda-setting power of the media is still there, but it can be directed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, other questions from the audience? We have time for just a couple more. Yes, in the back.
My question is for Jacob Goldstein, and that is, as a news reporter, I look every morning for news sources. And I found in the last 6 weeks or so, I've stopped looking at the Wall Street Journal health stories as a whole, but I'm looking at the blog instead. And so my question is, in how much are you a substitute? I know that you link to some stories, but I guess the basic question is, if I'm only reading the health blog, what percentage of the Wall Street Journal health stories am I looking at every day?
It's not 100. Is the short answer. And as I assume you know, there is a health sort of vertical on the journal site. So, I mean, if if you work in this space and if you need to see every health story that's in the journal, you should look briefly at that. Certainly, I would say probably more mornings than not, I end up blogging about one or more journal stories. And, you know, it's the same sort of a rough art that any editorial decision is. It's sort of, is this right? How does this fit with what we've done? What else is out there? So in short, no, I don't blog about every health story that's in the journal.
Other questions? Yes, right here.
Chris Vesper from American Occupational Therapy. I'm just wondering about legitimacy and factual information and how people are going to sort this out in the healthcare reform debate. I mean, last time around, we had Harry and Louise, of course, which a set of ads which were very influential, and then we had the rumors about, you know, we don't know who's meeting at the office if you ask anybody in town on a bus, they were probably meeting at the White House. Will we see Harry and Louise blogging? Will the interests involved use it? And I'm wondering if that kind of communication influenced the passage of the Massachusetts plan.
Oddly enough, there is talk about Harry and Louise blogging, because apparently the people who did that ad now regret doing it. But in answer to your question, I think that what you are going to see with legitimacy, which is, I think, an important question, is that blogs do legitimacy differently. They don't work off of authority. I mean, I'm up here talking to you all. I have limited authority, just given age. They work off of sourcing. And that is sort of how you're going to see that be different. There's this great poll that came out during the 94 reforms, and I think it's a really important one to think about when people begin talking about, oh, the media's in trouble. I think it might have, it wasn't Kaiser, but it's in David Broda's system in any case, if you want to source this. It is a poll that found that by the end of the debate, and this is a debate that took a year, it was on the front page of all papers, on all network news shows, Americans knew less about the specifics of the Clinton health care plan than when it began. So the day after Clinton's speech, they knew more than the day the debate ended after a year of straight coverage. So I don't know if it's going to be better or worse. I hope it will be better. But it's genuinely hard for me to understand how it could be worse. I mean, our ability to cover policy debates in this country is catastrophically bad. And the fact of having a medium in which the way people understand if you're lying to them or not is they click on the blue words, and the blue words either take them somewhere or they don't take them anywhere, is, I think, a significantly more transparent and sourceable way of doing this than, you know, watching the ads, just having, you know, Brian Williams tell you what the two spokespeople are saying. I think there's real opportunity for improvement, which is not to say there will be improvement, unfortunately.
Michael?
I think that there's a lot of room for improvement. I think you're going to get a lot better debate with this many more eyes on what's happening and voices contributing to the debate. I mean, no one's going to read the Cato at Liberty blog, or you're not going to get as many people reading that to see the Harry and Louise ads, or who see the ads that are going to be in favor of the next healthcare reform that comes down. But the Cato Institute, you know, builds a name for itself, a reputation for itself, in part because it cares a lot about the accuracy of what it says. Ezra Klein does the same thing. And you're going to have a lot of, you know, we're independent of industries that put out these enormous ads, and we're going to be out there fact-checking these ads in a way that is much quicker and much more useful to the people who read our blogs, including reporters, and then those fact checks are going to get disseminated much more quickly. I'm looking forward to the day when, in some healthcare debate, some member of Congress goes to the floor and says something, and then Ezra or I blog about it, and then some other member of the Congress goes to the floor and says what she said was wrong, not just because, you know, Michael or Ezra said so, but because, you know, here I have all of this information that they provided us. I think that you know, we're going to get. I'm not concerned about credibility. I think that there are bloggers out there that have earned reputations for credibility that have, and so you're going to have more credible voices in the next healthcare debate than we saw in the last one.
Tom,
I'm not a utopian. I hope I'm not a cynic. I would say just a couple of things. I don't know if there'll be better debate. There'll be more debate, but I don't think that blogs or the internet change human nature. when information is in oversupply or greater supply, it's harder to create knowledge because you have to sift through more stuff to figure out what it is that's true or not true. Mm-hmm. More argument and more information do not necessarily equate. And part of that is going to really depend on the quality of the blogosphere. I have a friend who's a former reporter, who's not a blogger, he's a PR man. And he said to me last year, I have six retainers on, blogs on retainer for my energy clients. And if I want to get something in them, I can just get them in there. Oh. So not all blogs are the people's medium.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid we've run a little bit over, so we're going to have to let that be the last word, and maybe we'll get together in a year and see where we're going, where we've gone since then. I want to thank all of the bloggers and all of the panelists for participating. Really appreciate it.